From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is the Political Junkie Podcast on Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. We are recording this conversation on Monday morning, August 5th, after what's been a deadly and devastating weekend in the United States. At least 21 people were killed in a mass shooting in El Paso Saturday morning. Then, at least 9 more people were killed in a different shooting in Dayton, Ohio, after midnight Saturday night. Ohio's Governor Mike DeWine was interrupted at a vigil with a chant that grew louder and louder. The words were, "Do something." And less than 2 hours ago, President Trump gave a 9-minute speech saying real bipartisan solutions are needed. So with that, let's begin this conversation with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Hi, Ken. This is still an evolving situation.
It is, Beth. And you know something, when you said something that when President Trump says he's calling for a bipartisan resolution, I almost have a sadness and a smile to it as well, because there have been in the past, you know, we are numb, as you point out, a horrific weekend with El Paso, followed by Dayton, and they were just all numb. But we were numb after Orlando. We were numb after Las Vegas. We were numb after Parkland. We were numb after Pittsburgh. I mean, I've been on your show for such a long time. We've talked for so long about these horrific acts of gun violence. And we all say somebody needs to do something. Congress needs to do something. And ultimately, nothing gets done. And within a few days, we move on to our other parts of life. But it's just numbness is actually the word that comes closest to mind right now.
You know, with you saying that, Ken, I'm thinking about the words I just used, that phrase, a deadly and devastating weekend in the United States. And we say the words, and there was a time when having to say those words twisted us all up inside. And now, for me, it's not numbness as much as it just is tragic. And you and I have differed on what we thought would spur action. I really thought after Parkland more would have happened. There were some actions taken. But clearly, when the chant is above all, do something, if that's a chant that grows louder and louder across the United States, electeds won't be able to be inactive on this.
I love your optimism. I cherish your optimism, but I do remember the conversation we had right after Parkland, and you were so enthused about what all these high schoolers were doing. They were going to march to Tallahassee. They were going to demand stronger gun laws. They were going to change the politics of the state. Well, nothing changed as far as it elected a Republican governor, it defeated a Democratic senator, elected a Republican to the Senate. The gun lobby is still as strong as ever. And again, when President Trump says, you know, we have to, you know, we need strong background checks. Well, he said that after Parkland, too, and that lasted a couple of days until he said, well, I'm just kidding. Well, he didn't really say I'm just kidding, but it felt like that. And when Congress, when the House passed 2 bills that basically would strengthen background checks, the president, who said he wanted background checks back then, said he would veto them. I know I love your enthusiasm, and I love your optimism. And I wish I could join in with you, but I've just seen this game played so many times before that I'm just not convinced. And I mean, maybe because it's back to back, it seems more grotesque than ever. And maybe with presidential candidates jumping on the anger, you know, being part of the anger in this country, maybe their voice will be even louder than we heard at a Parkland. But again, I'm not convinced of it. And of course, you still have a Republican Senate. You have Mitch McConnell, who is in no hurry to bring gun legislation to the Senate floor. Right now, there's still 5 more weeks of the Senate recess. That's not going to come back until early September. So
a bit of question about whether he would bring the Senate back into session early, although I guess the majority of people think that that's unlikely. But the president did say we vow to act with urgent resolve. I don't know what those words mean, but let's listen to a little bit of his national address today.
Open wounds cannot heal if we are divided. We must seek real bipartisan solutions. We have to do that in a bipartisan manner that will truly make America safer and better for all. First, we must do a better job of identifying and acting on early warning signs. I am directing the Department of Justice to work in partnership with local, state, and federal agencies, as well as social media companies, to develop tools that can detect mass shooters before they strike. As an example, the monster in the Parkland High School in Florida had many red flags against him, and yet nobody took decisive action. Nobody did anything. Why not?
Ken, he came up with some interesting angles, interesting conversations about this. Most of his remarks focused on people, what he called evil or wicked or monstrous people or the mentally ill. But maybe there is something to some of these conversations, and definitely to the early warning idea. Don't you agree?
Oh, I do. As I'm listening to this, to President Trump, who made these addresses on Monday morning, I'm listening and said he said everything right. He said the right things. And the fact is, there needs to be a national consensus on guns. It's not a question of whether you should still have Second Amendment rights. It's that should these people who have no business having guns to begin with being allowed to buy them? Should there be more background checks? And then what thing he didn't say is the fact that how it's so easy to, like, for example, if it's a tough background check in California, well, just slip over the border in Nevada and buy a semi-assault weapon and use that. So there are so many loopholes in the laws that the president sounds like he's willing to consider. And of course, that's exactly what he said basically last year in Parkland. And I remember thinking last year, I said, my goodness, this is not the Republican philosophy on guns. Maybe the crisis in this country has gotten so horrific that even President Trump could do it like a Nixon to China move, where it's so unlikely that a Republican president would make something change. But maybe this is the time. And then, you know, reality sets in, and then we're back to normal. So listening to the president on Monday, I think what he said was excellent. I think he had some new ideas, interesting ideas, and important ideas that I just hope that not only does the country listen to and Congress listen to, but the president listens to it as well, even though he just said it.
I'm talking with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Leading up to that number one on his list of four items, the early warning signs, he had talked about the internet and the perils of the internet and social media, and that being a place where the flagging, the early warning, the interruption of someone who might be on their way to a mass incident could happen. It was an interesting conversation about the internet coming from him in some ways. Ironic, although the way he brought it up sounded different, Ken. I don't know if I have the right words for it, but it did sound like there would be a different focus there.
Well, it's interesting. I think it is smart for the president to talk about guns, even though he normally would not want to do that. But the alternative to talking about guns is talking about the hate that's on the internet, the alleged killer in El Paso, for example, talked about a white supremacist screed that in some ways, look, I'm not going to say that the president caused this or the president's rhetoric is responsible for that. I mean, that is dangerous to talk in those terms. But the fact is that the alleged killer said some things about immigrants or wrote some things about immigrants that the president has said in the past. That, you know, we're not, how do we get rid of these people? How do we keep them from coming here? The president is stoking up anger. So, there are two Donald Trumps, there were two Barack Obamas, and there were two Richard Nixons, and there was two everybody. But it's most fascinating to watch President Trump, who is so capable, or seem at least as we saw today on Monday, so capable of trying to touch a chord in this country and touch people's heartstrings, where at the same time he can appear at a rally and talk about sending them back and keeping them away from here and how they're dangerous here. There are some people who listen to what the president has to say and take his words to an even more frightening extreme. Again, the point is not whether we're blaming the president for this, but he has to know that a lot of things he says can be insightful. And so, yes, it's one thing to say about healing and things like that. But if you believe in healing, you should also believe in keeping the rhetoric from getting out of hand to begin with. And the president is definitely guilty of that.
A couple things. In the manifesto, the gunman you're referring to also said that his attitude toward immigrants and some of his hatred preceded Trump. So that should be pointed out. Secondly, because...
Well, of course, people are using that as an excuse, saying, well, let's let the president off the hook because it precedes Trump. Look, Donald Trump didn't create hate in this country. Donald Trump didn't create this venom. But when you have a president who talks in this kind of rhetoric about them versus us, about people invading the country, well, there's some people who take it to a further extreme, and that's what I think happened in El Paso. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted
you. No, that's okay. When you say the word insightful, I think we're on radio, and it's important to say whether it's I-N-C-I-T-E, as in inciting.
I-N-C-I-T-E, exactly.
Yeah, versus I-N-S-I-G-H-T, because it can mean something totally different.
Absolutely, right. That's true. Thank you.
I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. So his list of four items included, as we're saying, early warning signs, acting on them. He talked about needing to attack the glorification of violence. He talked about mental health laws needing reform and that people at risk should not have access to firearms. I'm looping back to something, a point you made quickly, and that is that he talked about people and a lot of situations and circumstances surrounding gun violence. What I think you didn't say, and what a lot of people will say, is he didn't head on talk about guns, talk about assault weapons, talk about the presence of them and the numbers of them in the United States.
Well, I mean, he did say that we have to talk about everything. And of course, one would think that that would include that. But he also talked about, and maybe we should also work at immigration at the same time. And there were some people who said, well, that is absolutely a poison pill conversation, because the Congress is so split on immigration. To say that we should have gun laws put together with immigration laws, well, if that's what he's suggesting, that's almost that's almost doomed for failure. But again, the things he mentioned, the things he listed are key, are important, are crucial, that if people, you know, if you could just stop thinking about how you feel about guns and think more about all these senseless deaths in synagogues, in churches, in schools, in discos around the country. And it predates, talk about the shooter predating Trump with his views about invaders and immigrants. Well, these killings predate Trump as well. I mean,
right.
Don't you remember how many times Barack Obama went before the cameras to talk about his sorrow over what happened? So it's a cancer in this country. And again, I think Trump is given an unbelievable gift in that there's an opportunity to do something. I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm not saying it should be confiscation of guns. I'm not saying it should be this or that. But something needs to be done. Hmm. Why is the United States the only country in the world who has these mass shootings all the time? So, again, it's a tremendous opportunity for Trump and the people currently in office. And, you know, God help us that they don't forfeit this opportunity.
One last question. When you talked about the combination of some sort of reform and immigration, the gun violence and immigration, apparently he referenced that in a tweet, but then we didn't hear it in the speech. Is that a point that interests you, that in the tweets maybe we get the unfiltered real thoughts in a speech that was written and delivered by teleprompter, we're getting a different voice, a different person?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, obviously, although I do play one on Insight. But but the fact is, you're absolutely right. There are two, when the Trump speaking on Monday morning was much more majestic, shall we say, much more presidential than when you have a random tweet, when you blame the fake news for stoking the anger and the resentment about guns, when he talks about invasion, you know, on tweets. So, and he talks about, well, maybe it could only be immigration tied with guns for things to work. Who knows? I mean, yes, it's easy to read things that are written by other people, but if he sees, look, he's also very cognizant of what the polls are saying, because he loves to quote them all the time. If he sees that he may have touched the nerve with his speech Monday morning, his comments on Monday morning, maybe, you know, I mean, maybe if I'm sharing some of Beth Ruryak's optimism here, maybe something could happen. I fear the worst, but I hope for the best.
This is the Political Junkie podcast on Insight. I'm talking with Ken Rudin. And again, we're recording this conversation on Monday morning, August 5th, after the shootings happened over the weekend in both El Paso and Dayton. So, Ken, this topic is going to move quickly, much higher up to the top, I think, of the next presidential debate, which will be in September. Before we go there, let's talk about the second round of Democratic debates, which just happened this past week. It's behind us. Two interesting nights, again, 20 candidates divided over two nights. Just give me some of your initial analysis, then we're going to spend a little time on Kamala Harris in particular.
There were two different nights, Tuesday and Wednesday, and there were two completely different messages. At least that's what came to me as well. On Tuesday, it seemed to be, you know, we always talk about the battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Well, it seemed like there was a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party, too, with two candidates, on one side, notably Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Basically, not talking about revolution, but they're talking about big moves, big ideas. And a lot of them are about, you know, Medicare for all and free college tuition and the Green New Deal. These are big things that could cost a lot of money and could, you know, could change the whole picture on so many different issues. And they're challenged by the folks like John Hickenlooper of Colorado and John Delaney of Maryland and Steve Bullock of Montana, others who basically say that this is the middle class, the moderates, the centrists, the swing voters will never go for it. It's too extreme. It'll cost too much in taxes. It'll cost too much in jobs. What we have to do is be much more incremental. And that is the battle going on in the Democratic Party for a lot of things. The Bernie and Elizabeth, the kind of wing of saying, like, look, we are in bad shape. We need radical change. And the others say, well, you know, not yet. Whereas on Wednesday, it seemed like it was less of a philosophical battle. It was really about whether Joe Biden, who is described as the front runner, and in fairness, I mean, he leads in every poll I've ever seen. So in that sense, he is a front runner, even though we still have 6 months to go before Iowa and New Hampshire.
Right.
But why is he the front runner when it seems like both the June debate and last week's debate as well, that Biden either couldn't explain his views or was defensive? Look, when you're in the Senate for 36 years plus 8 years as vice president, you have a record that could be picked at. And of course, the politics of this country, let alone the politics of the Democratic Party, were much different in the 1970s. It was easy to, for example, oppose busing, stop, you know, busing in the 1970s. But for Kamala Harris and the new color and gender and youth of the Democratic Party, busing was means differently in 2019 than it did in 1975, for example. So Kamala Harris and others in the June debate and again in last week will take on Joe Biden for his so-called heresies of the 1970s. And even when Joe Biden tries to talk about how much he adores Barack Obama and everything that happened during the 8 years of Obama's presidency worked so well, well, then you have people like Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, or Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, who say, well, wait a second, what about all those deportations of immigrants during the Obama presidency? That wasn't something to be proud of. And Joe Biden didn't have a coherent answer in response.
So let's get to a little sound on what you're talking about. With the reference to the busing topic, which came up in June, let's fast forward to last week's debate, the second debate, and here's Kamala Harris talking about what she would have done if she was Joe Biden in the era of the busing legislation.
Had I been in the United States Senate at that time, I would have been completely on the other side of the aisle. And let's be clear about this. Had those segregationists their way, I would not be a member of the United States Senate, Cory Booker would not be a member of the United States Senate, and Barack Obama would not have been in the position to nominate him to the title he now holds. And so on that issue, we could not be more apart, which is that the vice president has still failed to acknowledge that it was wrong to take the position that he took at that time.
So Joe Biden had to have known that that was going to come up again and that he would hear this again. So let's hear a little bit of how the conversation evolves. You're going to hear Joe Biden and then some of the exchange between the two of them.
When Senator Harris was the attorney general for 8 years in the state of California, there were two of the most segregated school districts in the country, in Los Angeles and in San Francisco. And she did not, I didn't see a single solitary time she brought a case against them to desegregate them. Secondly, she also was in a situation where she had a police department when she was there that, in fact, was abusing people's rights. And the fact was that she, in fact, was told by her own people, that her own staff, that she should do something about and disclose to defense attorneys like me that you, in fact, have been, the police officer did something that did not give you information would exculpate your client. She didn't do that. She never did it. And so what happened? Along came a federal judge and said, enough, enough, and he freed 1,000 of these people. If you doubt me, Google 1,000 prisoners freed Kamala Harris.
Thank you, Vice President Biden. Senator Harris, your response?
That this is simply not true. And as Attorney General of California, where I ran the second largest Department of Justice in the United States, second only to the United States Department of Justice, I am proud of the work we did, work that has received national recognition for what has been the important work of reforming a criminal justice system and cleaning up the consequences of the bills that you passed when you were in the United States Senate for decades.
So in this debate, Kamala Harris, the California senator running for president, becomes a target. And how do you think she handled that, Ken?
Well, she became a target because she did so well in that June debate. I mean, she was probably the star of the second June debate when she stood up to Joe Biden. Whereas here, so much of Kamala Harris's responses were, it's simply not true. It's not true. And when Joe Biden attacked her stewardship as being attorney general, even more so when Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment.
It seemed like she had to know. Kamala Harris had to know that she would be a target as well because she kind of moved up in the polls and moved up in people's conversations after the first debate. And she seemed a little, I think the words I would use are unsteady. She didn't seem as sure of herself as she seemed back in June. She, other than saying it's simply not true, and actually, and then she responded to Biden by saying, well, if it weren't for your stewardship of the crime bill of 1994, but that still didn't explain her actions when she was attorney general. So I think that once you prove yourself to be a leader, you are already have a bullseye on your back. Biden had it in the first two debates. I think Kamala Harris had it last week as well. And my gut tells me that she didn't handle herself as solidly as she did in the June debate, as the way she did last week.
So let's go a few minutes later in the debate when the attack on Kamala Harris comes from Tulsi Gabbard, the representative from Hawaii.
I want to bring the conversation back to the broken criminal justice system that is disproportionately negatively impacting Black and brown people all across this country today. Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way.
Thank you, Congresswoman. Senator Harris, your response.
As the elected Attorney General of California, I did the work of significantly reforming the criminal justice system of a state of 40 million people, which became a national model for the work that needs to be done. And I am proud of that work. And I am proud of making a decision to not just give fancy speeches or be in a legislative body and give speeches on the floor, but actually doing the work of being in the position to use the power that I had to reform a system that is badly in need of reform.
Ken, a lot of time in these debates has been spent on healthcare, but do exchanges like that, moments like that, have a huge influence overall in how, to what degree, a candidate can keep moving forward in the polls and then on the debate stage toward the primary?
That's an important question, because if you listen, I mean, I don't want to focus only on Kamala Harris, because it seemed like there was a food fight the entire second debate among other candidates as well. But the fact is, over and over again, she would say, I'm proud of the work we did as Attorney General. I fought for reform. But she didn't really answer Biden's attack or Gabbard's attack. And sometimes you think, well, maybe, you know, it's going to hurt Harris, or maybe it's going to hurt. It could hurt the entire Democratic Party, because as somebody pointed out, it may have been Buttigieg or it may have been Kirsten Gillibrand, but you said, you know, we have to remember that the target here is really President Trump. But for the Democrats to go after each other, it was pretty almost sad. If you're a Democrat, look, if you're a Democrat and you want to be President Trump next year, you don't want Democrats sniping in each other. Now, of course, that's what debates are for. You need to know the differences among the candidates, and sometimes an attack needs to be made and answered. But if it's going to be compare Wednesday, the second night of the debate, to the Tuesday debate, when Elizabeth Warren was not attacked, whether her policies are viable or not, she was very clear. She was very concise. She was very, basically what she was describing and what she wants was not in question. And so there were ways of campaigning. So I think the reason I think Elizabeth Warren came out better last week, and I think the reason Kamala Harris came off worse, is because how you sell yourself, how you sell your record, and how you sell your philosophy. And if you're basically on the defensive and sputtering, and if you're Joe Biden, say, well, you know, I know, but Cory Booker, you stunk as mayor of Newark. Well, Bill de Blasio, what's going on in New York City? That's not the way to do it. I don't think it's the way to do it. And so, you know, I don't know if you could have 10 losers in a debate, but I didn't see any big winners coming out of last Wednesday.
Well, there were some interesting standout performances. Kirsten Gillibrand in this round of debates was really on fire compared to the first time. A lot of people think Cory Booker had a terrific night in the debates. And Marianne Williamson, again, is getting a lot of attention. And let's talk about Andrew Yang, a different person from the first round, certainly, in July.
Well, yes. I mean, Andrew Yang had the great line about the thought of an Asian guy who's great at math. I mean, that was very
being
funny.
The opposite and of President Trump, right?
Exactly. And Marianne Williamson, again, got more Google searches after the first two debates than any other candidate, because they were, one, because they probably never heard of her, and two, they were fascinated by what she had to say. But is she going to be the next nominee for president? And that's the question. You know, as of now, there are 8 candidates so far who have qualified for the next round of debate, September 12th and 13th. It's Bernie Sanders, it's Elizabeth Warren, it's Joe Biden, it's Pete Buttigieg, it's Beto O'Rourke, it's Cory Booker, it's Kamala Harris, it's Amy Klobuchar. I think that's all 8. But there are other candidates, as I say, who are very fascinating, very interesting, great sound bites, great ideas. The Andrew Yangs and the Marianne Williamsons and the Jay Inslees and the Steve Bullocks. But at some point, the Democrats are going to have to make some kind of order out of a very unruly system, and we'll see who makes it to the September debates.
So can some of the field for the next debate still to be decided based on qualifying polls and fundraising? So by the time we talk again in September, we will know that list. And as you said, thinking that there's still 6 months till Iowa is pretty phenomenal at this point.
Well, you know, so not only do we going to see how many candidates are left standing, at least for the September debates, but I'm also going to be interested when we speak again in September, how much of the debate we're having right now about gun violence in this country, how long it will be sustained, and whether the candidates and the president could somehow come to a meeting of the minds and get something done, which I think everybody, Democrats and Republicans alike, feel is so necessary.
All right, Ken, as always, thanks for the conversation. Take care.
Thank you, Beth.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie. He joins us for this podcast from the Washington, D.C. area. And this is Insight on CAP Radio.